well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Going to be talking with a friend, Costas Morris, from the Second Amendment Foundation. The deadline for public comment on the 36 proposed rules by the ATF has now been reached, and it's up to the ATF to now wade through all of those public comments and promulgate the final rule or not pull back the proposed rule. Actually, that's already happened with at least one of the proposals that the ATF had thrown out there. Second Amendment Foundation, along with a number of other Second Amendment groups and gun control activists, submitting public comments during this period. I saw a story, I wrote about it actually at Bearing Arms earlier today. Senate Democrats, including Dick Durbin, Chris Murphy, Richard Blumenthal, and Adam Schiff, objecting specifically to one regulation that would improve and update the ATF's interpretation of the Firearm Owners Protection Act. I want to start actually our conversation with Costas Morris there, because I think that's one of the most important proposals that the ATF put forward, and the complaints by the anti-Democrats are, frankly, ludicrous. So let's start there with Costas Morris. Take a look and a listen. Costas, thanks very much for coming on the program. It's good to see you again.
Always a pleasure, Cam, and it's great to see you too.
You know, there are a number of these rules that I want to talk about, but I want to start with the FOPA reform. As I mentioned in my introduction, Senator Durbin, Schiff, Blumenthal, and Murphy have written a letter to Robert Sakata urging him to pull back this rule because of the unprecedented public safety concerns. If someone can stop and take a leak, you know, as they're traveling, or they can, you know, stay the night in a hotel without worrying about committing a crime. Can you describe what the ATF is trying to do here with FOPA? And can you see anything in what they're proposing that would create a public safety risk?
Well, look, the anti-gun side has become a bit of the boy who cried wolf on this stuff, except that there won't actually ever be a wolf in this scenario. But because they always claim every reform, no matter what, is going to kill everyone. We heard this with CCW permits. We've heard this with everything, right? So in this case, though, they really don't have a leg to stand on, because both FOPA itself, by its plain language, is supposed to protect exactly this. It's incidental stops were never meant to undermine it. Otherwise, there would be no point to its protections. And more importantly, and as our comment letter covers, we also believe there's a constitutional argument for this, even aside from FOPA, about why this should have to be allowed under the Second Amendment. It's not surprising to me that, I think you mentioned Senator Schumer was one of them. New York's airports and New Jersey's airports are notorious for arresting people and telling them essentially to tell it to the judge when they'd raise FOPA as a defense. You know, and a lot of those charges do get dismissed, but that's still a big legal bill, a big hassle, a big stress, and they clearly hate FOPA and want to undermine it. Well, the ATF is trying to stop that now.
Yeah. And actually, Schumer, not a part of this. It was a Schiff, senator. The two senators from Connecticut, and then Durbin from Illinois. But
I must have misheard. Sorry.
But no, yeah. You're absolutely right, though, about the Port Authority. I mean, we've seen cases where people are traveling. Their flight gets diverted to Newark because of weather. They can't get on another flight until the next morning. So they leave the airport. They with their luggage. They go back the next morning. They try to check their luggage, including their firearm. And then they get arrested for having that gun in New Jersey. Right. Yeah. What are they supposed to do? Stay in the airport overnight, I guess. Even then, I'm not even sure that would make a difference.
I've literally read legal blogs from that area from lawyers who handle this that say the best thing to do is not even pick up your luggage. Refuse to take it until you can leave, because you will. But the moment you take it, you're breaking their dumb law. So this is and that's insane, right? You're going to leave your luggage at the airport with a gun in it, especially if you need your luggage.
Right.
It's preposterous. But that is the best legal advice they're giving right now. So that's exactly what this is meant to address. FOPA was never intended to create traps like this. It was supposed supposed to be literally called the Firearm Owners Protection Act. It wouldn't be much protection if it's a gotcha, which is essentially what this is in certain parts of the country. Oh, your flight got delayed. No more protection for you. Go to straight to jail.
Right. Like, oh, you broke your leg. Sense. You got to go to the ER. Oh, yeah. Go to jail. You know, I think that of all of the rules that the ATF put forth, all of the proposals, this one may actually have the biggest impact to the most amount of gun owners around the country. Would you agree?
Yeah, there's a reason. Of the 7 comment letters we wrote, this was the first one I drafted. So, okay. Yeah, I agree that this one is going to have the big, because a lot of these rules are great. Even a lot of the ones we wrote in support of are great, but they're actually not going to help people like me in California. A lot of this stuff is just life gets even better for red state gun owners. But this one would actually protect even people in blue states who are traveling. So it matters to everybody that this gets across the finish line.
And before we move on from this particular rule, you mentioned that there's a constitutional issue as well. I assume that you're talking about the traveler's exceptions. Yes, I know that you've written about this quite extensively in the past. The idea that, you know, if there's a national tradition regarding firearms being carried across state lines, it's that generally travelers have been able to exercise their rights more freely than residents have in many cases, right?
Right. So we originally argued this in CCW case, and we're still arguing it in carry reciprocity cases. And what it is basically is in the 19th century, and actually going back before the founding era, there was what's called a traveler's exception. And the context that usually applied in was states would often ban concealed carry specifically. It could still open carry, but concealed carry was often banned. But they'd make an exception for travelers. They'd say, well, if you're traveling, you're on a journey, you can carry concealed. And that's because they knew travelers had to stow guns or do whatever else, and it would be too hard for them to carry openly all the time. You know, we think that makes the argument for carry reciprocity, but it's an even stronger argument for FOPA, you know, and what FOPA intends to do, because it's a much more modest request. FOPA doesn't say carry. FOPA just says it's a gun that's stowed away in your luggage. Like, it's an even more perfect fit for the traveler's exception. So we hope that the ATF, when they inevitably probably get sued over this, but when they adopt it by the, you know, usual suspect blue states, I'm sure they'll sue, they should make a constitutional argument. Ironically, it's the ATF making a Second Amendment argument, but they should make a constitutional argument, not just the FOPA argument, although I think the FOPA argument should be enough, but they should make both and argue why this also complies with the Constitution.
Boy, I would love to see the day when the ATF makes a Second Amendment argument in defense of a rule. All right, one of the other letters that or public comments that you submitted is on the ATF's proposal for non-over-the-counter sales. This is another one where I think Brady had Chris Brown and said, oh, it's going to lead to more violent crime. You know, people are going to be able to buy guns willy nilly. So under this process, I mean, honestly, the way I read it, it's such a there's a really exhaustive process for you to be able to prove your identity online. I don't know that I'd take advantage of this proposed rule because I think it'd be easier for me to just go down to my local gun shop. But this would allow for individuals to prove their identity through a third party system, right? Like ID.me. Once that happens, you still have to do a video conference call with the FFL to verify you are who you say you are. But you can, I guess, fill out the form 4473 online that can be submitted online. The background check can be submitted online. And this, by the way, is an FFL in your home state who could then transfer that firearm to you without you having to go to the gun shop. That's exactly right.
So it would be, it's kind of a little bit how suppressors already work, but yes, it would be a dual process. You know, there's this whole argument going around right now that, oh, this is going to just enable straw purchases. Some kid will be able to steal his dad's ID and buy a gun. And that's nonsense, because the way the ID verification technology works, that's impossible. Plus, you also have to do the video recording with yourself. So you're going to have to speak with them remotely so they can verify that your ID matches the person speaking with them. But regardless, they don't actually fear, I think, any public safety about this. This is about continuing to make gun sales more difficult, more of a pain. I think if the industry, I'm getting a little outside my lane here because I'm not in the industry, but I think if the industry adopted this, they probably could make it pretty streamlined and straightforward to enable these sort of sales. And frankly, what I was surprised by with this rule, when I was drafting it, I was reviewing some of the comments that were already posted. And yes, there were the usual anti-gun suspects, you know, saying, you know, everyone's going to die or whatever they always say. But there was a lot of comments from gun stores opposing this. And most of those comments, frankly, were protectionism. They don't want the competition from online markets. And they would, some of them just said that straight out. It was a few sentences saying, oh, this will kill small businesses. Okay. But there were a few that were saying, making the anti-gunner argument saying, oh, and this will make straw purchases easier. But you could tell the real reason was they were scared of online competition. And to that, I say, look, I understand why it's scary for a brick and mortar store to do that, but every other industry in America has had to deal with this. Why should the gun industry be stuck in 1995 with no online sales, or online sales at least that are very difficult and you have to ship to the FFL and that? So we think this is an important change. And we also argue in our comment letter that, again, it's in line with our historical tradition, and there's a Second Amendment argument for it as well.
So. Yeah. And I saw your post on X about the objections from gun stores. And, you know, honestly, like, I understand their argument. I do understand their concerns. But as you say, virtually every other industry has had to deal with the rise of online sales. And this really, I think, would be getting into pure protectionism if this rule does not go forward. One of the other comments that you all made is on the ATF's proposal revising the definition of mental illness. And this is, again, one of the proposed rules where the sky is falling, according to the gun control activists, because there's language in this proposed rule. And I talked with Robert Sakata about this when I interviewed him last month when I went up to ATF headquarters. There's language in there that, you know, this could lead to mass shootings. It could lead to nothing, but it could also lead to mass shootings, right? And the reason why that language is there is because, as Robert Sakata explained to me, the ATF is required to put forth, like, okay, well, what bad things could happen as a result of this, right? No matter how realistic or likely that may be. And so that is, I guess, one of the theoretical issues that somebody who right now would be denied could purchase a firearm, could go on to do nefarious things. Whether that's likely, I mean, he didn't seem to think so. And if you look at what the actual changes are, I don't think that's likely either. I mean, the big change is basically an adjudication, you know, like we've seen with the VA or the Social Security Administration, the appointment of a fiduciary is seen as an adjudication of mental illness, and that would no longer be the case, right?
Yeah, I don't think increased mass shootings are likely, but yeah, it is possible. But I would push back on anyone arguing that, especially on the anti-gun side. Would they think then that, you know, if a jury decides not to convict someone and that person goes on to commit a murder, like, does that mean that they should convict everyone all the time? Does that mean we shouldn't have search and seizure protections? Because we could get a lot of crime off the streets if we just tossed out the Fourth Amendment and other amendments, you know? Yes, there's a risk that when you honor rights, someone somewhere might do something bad, but that's true of a lot of rights. And I think this one is frankly a very unlikely risk because it doesn't put anybody who we'd actually consider crazy back into armed status. What it does is, like you said, it would be people who are fiduciaries, people who have fiduciaries to handle financial affairs. It's kind of insane, frankly, to say that on that alone, without more evidence, just the fact that they are getting a little older, can't handle financial affairs, means that they have to not be able to defend themselves. Also, like with the general issue of disarming people who seek mental help, this will just discourage people from seeking help if they do need a little bit of help with some things. You know, imagine someone older with a large gun collection. He's starting to struggle a little bit with finances or being able to manage that. And now he's like, well, I don't want to seek help. They're going to take my guns. You know, that's mm-hmm. a terrible precedent. So this is a good one. This is one of our shorter comment letters because we think it was very straightforward. We just basically said, you know, this is in line with what Hamani said, you and Brahimi, you have to disarm only based on dangerousness. And we cited, ironically, the Seventh Circuit's new ruling in United States v. Rose, where they said permanent disarmament on the mental health disqualifier is unconstitutional, because they said if you can show you've gotten better, then you should be able to get your rights back. And we don't even think this goes that far, because this person wasn't even, or this rule doesn't contemplate someone who is actually mentally defective. But the point is, if even the Seventh Circuit is having doubts about the expansiveness of this law, clearly this far more limited scope that the ATF is talking about is fine.
Yeah. And, you know, some of the public comments from the gun control advocates indicate that they want to go much further, right? I mean, again, you talk about the potential harms with discouraging people from seeking help. I mean, I've seen comments from gun control advocates that basically, if you are in therapy, if you are under a psychiatrist's care, you should lose your ability to own a firearm. If you voluntarily check yourself into a mental hospital, that should be a disqualifier for you owning a firearm going forward. I mean, they want to broaden this. And the ATF's proposal, as you say, I think just narrows this down a little bit. One of the other letters that you guys wrote, and this is, I haven't seen a lot of pushback from the gun control groups, but I have seen some pushback from like LGBT activists. This is a rule that requires when you're filling out the 4473 you have to select your biological sex on the form. Right. And there have been some folks who say, well, this is a way to target transgender gun owners. You know, it's designed to trip them up. It's designed to, you know, you can charge somebody with a crime. Is that a real pitfall, you think, with this proposal?
I don't think it's the intention. So as we say in our comment letter, and I think Rob Leiter's given interviews about this too, he says that it's just what the Trump administration's unrelated executive orders require. You have to have this. You can't have the non-binary option or whatever. And SAF doesn't really take a position on the transgender, gender identity debate, but we do take a position that every peaceable person has a right to keep and bear arms. So what we suggest to ATF is that our concern here isn't so much that ATF intends to disarm people, because we don't think that's the case, but what it might do is cause confusion for gun dealers. So let's say a gun dealer sees someone who he thinks is a man, say, I'm a woman on the form. Well, now he's like, well, can I sell this gun now? Because this is clearly false, in my opinion. So what we suggest to the ATF is a couple of things. One, they could remove the question altogether from the form, just not have the male or female designation, because there's all this other information on the form to verify identity. Another option is you could tell dealers that they can't deny based on that question alone. So people still fill it out, but that's not grounds to ever deny someone. Or they just put out guidance to all dealers explaining the situation, be like, this is why we're doing this. This is why it's required. But again, don't deny people based on it. It's just, you know, this is a result of the executive order or whatever. So we think that while we don't really agree with some of the opinion that this is meant to be a quote unquote transgender gun ban, we do think it could cause confusion, and ATF should clarify that before it does cause confusion and get otherwise lawful sales denied.
Okay. There are a couple of other letters that you all sent regarding firearm records retention, the shortening of the Form 4473, and the transport of interstate firearm rules. Is there anything in particular with those three proposed rules, Costas, that you think needs to be highlighted?
The NFA transport one is just a similar to our interstate transport. It's similar to the FOPA one. It's same arguments. You know, we don't think people should have to wait for NFA approval when they're traveling, because, you know, if you have last minute travel plans, a 4-day or 5-day wait, which is what it currently is, could you make it so that you can't take your guns with you, your NFA items anyway. So that one's pretty similar to the other one. The Form 4473, it's One main issue, I think there was a couple minor ones, but the main issue was that the cannabis question, or sorry, the drug user question now needs to change in light of Hamani. So that's basically the argument we make. And the last one, records retention period, we think it's too long. So we applaud the ATF for at least putting back some limit, but we think 30 years is ridiculous. We think it should be 10 years. And we think that ATF data on traces shows that 10 years would encompass the vast majority of guns actually used in crime, because once a gun has been sold for more than 10 years, it's very rarely actually used in crime, I think, according to the ATF's own data. So we think that would be the best balance of, you know, having records but still being able to trace firearms, but also protecting gun owner privacy. Oh, and one other issue we noticed, and this might just be, I think ATF, I'm not sure if they have the technology to do this yet, but apparently when a gun store goes out of business and ATF gets those records, the 30 years would reset. So let's say a gun store goes out of business after 20 years. They've had records for 20 years. A gun was sold in, you know, this year, it goes out of business in 20 years. ATF gets the records and then that resets. So you get it for another 30 years. And I don't know if they have any way to track those, because a lot of these are paper records. So how would they, unless they go through them one by one, but we think that's an issue as well. It should be, you know, it shouldn't be a reset. It should be cumulative. Even if they go with 20 or 30 years, it should just be from the date of sale, regardless of if the gun store goes out of business and the records go to the ATF. If we think this is just an issue of protecting privacy and defending against a registry. So,
okay. You know, all right. Yeah. So now that the public comment period is closed, ATF has to go through all of the public comments, right? And then what's the next step? They'll either revise these rules, they'll issue the final rule, or they'll rescind these proposals. Are those basically the three options they have?
Yeah, I don't see them. I hope I'm wrong. I don't see them rescinding too many. Granted, as you noticed, we didn't really do any comment letters on the industry side because I just didn't really understand. I wouldn't have said anything useful other than sounds great, guys, you know, because I don't know anything about importing. But I from the ones we've commented on, I think they have very strong arguments. I don't see them rescinding them. I think they might tweak some of them, but we'll see. I think the one they did rescind was because it was it was supposed to go into effect immediately, or it was a proposed final rule, and they just got overwhelmingly negative response. I think that was the easy, I forget what it was called, about a month ago. So these are different though, because they're going through the ordinary rulemaking. So even if, you know, the anti-gun side swamped the comments with spam and it was 9-1 against us, it actually comes down to the quality of the arguments, not just the number of the comments, right? So we think the arguments in our favor are stronger, and we think, I hope ATF will agree and, you know, tweak them as needed, but otherwise adopt these rules.
Yeah. All right.
Well, Costas, we've seen how long it can take, though. I mean, we're still waiting for that rights restoration rule. I don't know. I know Rob Leiter's a big nerd like me, so I'm sure he's going to be working very hard to get through these. But I don't know what's going on. We'll see how long it takes.
Yeah, we've been hearing about that rights restoration rule for about almost a year and a half now, right? And I think we were told back in March, I think the DOJ said, oh, we'd be rolling this out very soon. And here it is August. And
Todd Blanche said at SHOT Show, this was back before he was acting attorney general, but at SHOT Show, he had said in an interview, it would be ready by March. And now we're in August. So I don't know what's going on.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we don't have to wait a year and a half for these rules to be finalized. And Costas, again, appreciate you joining me on the program. Appreciate everything you're doing there at the Second Amendment Foundation. I know we've got a lot to discuss going forward. We're still waiting on the Third Circuit opinion on the sensitive places. We've got to the Supreme Court cases coming up, and there's, you know, SAF is working on literally dozens of different lawsuits at the various levels of district court, the appellate court, and the Supreme Court as well. So no shortage of topics. I would love to have you back on very soon.
Anytime, Kim. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Costas Moros joining us from the Second Amendment Foundation here on Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. My thanks, as always, to Costas for joining us on the program. Looking forward to having him back again here soon. All right, let's turn our attention now to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with perhaps the most recidivist of the recidivist reports we've done recently. Man with 30 arrests robbed woman on CTA, then walked into Taco Bell where she works, according to prosecutors. This is from CWB Chicago. the individual in question, again, well known to law enforcement officers, he apparently on July 29th at a Red Line station went up to a 39-year-old woman, sat down next to her, and asked if she had any minutes on the phone that she was holding. That's when 29-year-old Devon Thomas then looked around to see if anybody was watching, slapped the woman's hand down, took her phone, and then ran away. According to CWB Chicago, CTA surveillance cameras recorded the robbery, and detectives quickly distributed photos of the suspect to the city's transit cops. So later that day, the victim is at her job at a Taco Bell when she sees Thomas walk in. She then watched him leave the restaurant, maybe after he spotted her, and started walking down the street. She was able to flag down police, described what she was, what the suspect was wearing. Officers suspected that Thomas would return to the Red Line, so they went to the nearest station, and sure enough, they arrested him after he allegedly jumped the turnstile at the Jackson Red Line station. Thomas's arrest report says officers recognize him from internal bulletins about the woman's robbery, as well as another robbery that had been reported that day, although Thomas has not been charged with that crime, at least as of yet. Judge in Cook County ordered Thomas detained on a robbery charge. He was already on pretrial release at the time of the robbery for a misdemeanor retail theft case that was filed on July the 9th. And according to CWB Chicago, Thomas's 30 arrests in the city since 2015 have resulted in two felony convictions. One in 2016, a robbery conviction in which Thomas received nothing more than probation. And then another in 2024, an aggravated battery conviction that resulted in a 2-year prison sentence. But again, in Illinois, you get a day off your sentence for every day that you spend behind bars and you don't assault a fellow inmate or a correctional officer, right? Time off for good behavior basically cuts your sentence in half. And in addition to that, the time that you spend in jail awaiting trial or on electronic monitoring awaiting trial counts towards your sentence as well. So Devon Thomas received a 2-year prison sentence 2 years ago. He likely served much less time than that. And then, of course, the other 28 cases, we don't know the outcomes, right? We don't know if he was acquitted in some cases, if some of these cases were null pros by prosecutors, if he was sentenced to nothing more than probation. We don't know. But 30 arrests, even if a couple of those were, false arrests, I can't imagine that was the case 28 out of 30 times, right? And so here you have somebody who is, again, well-known in the criminal justice system, eligible for a free Subway sandwich, I guess, right? After 30 arrests, you would think, I guess, 3 sandwiches at that point. And yet, the criminal justice system in Cook County just continues to spit this guy right back out onto the streets. Today's armed citizen story from Alabama, where a suspect has been identified in a Tuscumbia home burglary investigation. Casey Ray Wilbanks was recently released from custody. He does face a burglary charge after authorities say he was shot by a homeowner during a Tuscumbia break-in. I can't imagine that makes it really difficult for you to say, hey, I got an alibi. I wasn't there. If you, in fact, were shot. According to a Shoals Insider, Tony Logan, who's the Tuscumbia Public Safety Director, said that Will Banks was shot in the ankle after allegedly entering a home on South Milton Avenue. This would have been last Saturday morning. Police got a 911 call around 3:15 in the morning from a woman who said that her husband had shot an intruder inside their home. Emergency crews took Will Banks to a local hospital for treatment. According to the public safety director, investigators are still reviewing evidence. They do expect Wilbanks to be charged with burglary once he's released from the hospital. Not sure why Wilbanks decided to allegedly enter this home. They say it did, though, just happen days after Wilbanks had previously been released from custody. He pleaded guilty in May to unlawful possession of a controlled substance. He got a 36-month suspended sentence. Officials say that that sentence could now be imposed following the latest incident. Could, not will, there. But we'll keep our eyes on this situation and again, very glad that the homeowner was able to protect himself and his wife against that late night or early morning intruder last Saturday. Finally, today, our good deed of the day, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing, a Massachusetts man who hit a stop button for a woman trapped in an escalator where a man actually died just a couple of months earlier after also becoming stuck. Apparently, this woman, piece of clothing got caught in the escalator, so she falls down on the, not on the ground, but she falls down on this escalator. And according to WISN, actually, I guess this is from a WCBB in Boston, a Good Samaritan who was riding ahead of her hit the emergency stop button, then helped her take off the piece of clothing that was stuck. She was taken to a local hospital for a hand injury. She is expected to be okay. You know, ordinarily, I don't even think this would make news, but because of what happened just a couple of months ago, it is newsworthy. In February, a guy named Stephen McCluskey died after he fell while riding the same escalator at the Davis Square station. He, again, piece of clothing got stuck in the machinery. He tried to get up, failed to do so, continued to try to free himself until he became motionless. WCVB says the video, surveillance video from the scene, showed several people just walking by McCluskey. Several others saw what was going on, and they decided, well, I'll take the stairs. Just one person stopped to try to help him. And even that individual just gave up and walked away. Didn't yell out, hey, I need help. Nothing. That to me is so sad. Over 20 minutes after McCluskey fell, police and EMT showed up on the scene. And McCluskey was determined to choke to death on this article of clothing that, again, got trapped in the escalator. So, you know, this is a simple thing. Hit that big red stop button. Nobody did that for Stephen McCluskey. Thankfully, a good Samaritan did it for this woman in Somerville, Massachusetts, and in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the simplest of things to save another's life. We thank that good Samaritan for his very good deed. And that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. Looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. But be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day today, where we are keeping you abreast of all of the latest Second Amendment news and information across the nation. We're still keeping our eyes on the Third Circuit. I want to see the Coons-Plackin decision. No, not Plackin. The Coons-Siegel decision. That's right. The New Jersey Sensitive Cases, Sensitive Places case. There you go. Still waiting to hear what the Third Circuit has to say about those gun-free zones. Been hearing it could come out any time. Today would be a great day. But whenever it comes out, we got you covered. Again, we'll see you at BearingArms.com. We'll see you back here again tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.